Having adopted their appearance and speech, the Buddha addresses the members of the various assemblies. The text speaks of him as delivering a discourse on Dhamma. The word Dhamma, or Dharma in Sanskrit, has quite a number of meanings. But here, in this particular context, it means something like truth or reality. It's the truth or reality, we may say, that was, in a manner of speaking, the objective content of the Buddha's experience, his spiritual, his transcendental experience, when he became enlightened, when he became a Buddha. Now, the text does not actually say what the Buddha said. It simply says that he delivered a discourse on Dhamma. It doesn't mention any specific teaching. But it does tell us what the effect of the Buddha's discourse was. For the gods or men, the Buddha's hearers were instructed, inspired, fired, and delighted. And this is very important. It's important because religion, a discourse, shouldn't just instruct us, shouldn't just communicate factual information, even of a religious nature, important though such information may be and useful though it may be. It should also inspire us. It should fire us with enthusiasm. It should fill us with overwhelming delight. One often listens to such a discourse or sermon with feelings very far removed from those of overwhelming delight. But if it cannot do that, if it cannot inspire and fire and delight us, well, it won't affect us. It won't sink in. We won't remember it. It won't help us to change our lives. Another little incident, you know, from my life in India. I used to give so many lectures in India. William was asking me just a little while ago, or rather he was reminding me that I didn't give many talks these days. And I said, well, yes, I don't. But I used to give hundreds in India. And I used to go around villages and towns in especially North India and Western India, Central India. And sometimes I'd give a talk where I'd given a talk perhaps 15, 20 years earlier. And people would remember. But what would they remember? They always remembered the stories. They remembered the parables. They didn't always remember the principles or the rules or anything of that sort. But the parables, the stories, they remember because the stories had delighted them. The stories had fired them. The stories had even inspired them, so they remembered them. I think that is a very important point. So, we see that the Buddha's hearers in each of the eight assemblies were instructed, inspired, fired, and delighted. The Khatriyas were delighted, the Brahmins were delighted, and so on. Even, we are told, the Maras or Satans were delighted. And think what an achievement that must have been, It's very interesting, because the Maras or Satans in Buddhism are wicked, even evil beings. Wicked or evil, supernatural or supernormal beings. But the Buddha nonetheless adopts their appearance and speech too. He doesn't shrink from that. He enters their assembly too. He delivers a discourse on Dhamma to them. And what is the result? They too are instructed, inspired, fired, and delighted. Presumably they're permanently affected. Presumably they are changed. Presumably they cease to be Satans. Presumably they become angels. This is an example of what we may describe as the radical optimism of Buddhism. That is to say, Buddhism's conviction that even the wickedest person, even the most monstrously evil person, can change. And this is perhaps reminiscent, if we look at the Christian tradition, reminiscent of Origen's belief that even the devil will eventually be saved. This is a belief, of course, which the Christian church as a whole has not, unfortunately, shared. But after they have been instructed, inspired, fired, and delighted with the Buddha's discourse on the Dhamma, what do the members of the different assemblies do? What do they say? They say, who is it that speaks like this? A deva or a man? Who is it that speaks like this? The Buddha has come among them like one of themselves. But they know that it cannot be one of themselves speaking. They've never been so deeply affected before. It's rather like what happens when we read a wonderful poem by a poet of whom we've never heard before. A wonderful poem. We want to know more about him. We want to know who he is. Who is this wonderful new poet? So, in the same way, the Buddhas hear us all ask, who is it that speaks like this? They're full of wonder. They're overwhelmed. They know that someone has spoken to them. They know it's not one of themselves, even though appearing like one of themselves. They want to know who it is. So they try to identify him. They try to categorize him. And this, of course, is what we usually do. We try to understand the unknown with the help of the known, the unfamiliar with the help of the familiar. Sometimes it works, and very often it works, and sometimes it doesn't. And the Khatiyas and the Brahmins and the others, they seem to operate with two principal categories. They ask, is he a deva, that is to say, a god, or a man? It seems not to occur to them that there is any third category. Is he a deva, a god, or a man? And this is very much the situation in the West today. We still operate with these two categories. The Buddha, we may say, has appeared amongst us. He's appeared in the West, appeared in Europe, appeared in America, not, of course, in the flesh. We've learned about him from books. He's appeared to us from the pages of books. And we've seen pictures, we've seen images of him, some of them very impressive, very inspiring, very beautiful. And we've become acquainted with his teachings, at least to some extent. And perhaps we've even been impressed by him and his teaching. And so we want to know more about him. And we ask, who is the Buddha? And sometimes we don't really wait for an answer. We try to answer the question ourselves. We seek to categorize the Buddha by applying to him terms with which we are already familiar, just like the Khatiyas and Brahmins and others. And thus, we see him either as a man, either as a human teacher, rather like Socrates, or perhaps like Confucius, or we see him as a kind of Oriental God. Sometimes, if we're a wee bit more sophisticated, we think that the Buddha was a human teacher whom his followers, unfortunately, made into a god. And we talk of the Buddha's followers of having deified him. Sometimes scholars even speak of the Buddha being a human teacher in the Theravada and a deified figure in the Mahayana, and so on. You may remember those famous lines of Kipling from his poem Mandalay. These reflect the popular view of the Buddha as a god. Blooming idol made of mud, what they call the great gourd bud. From Mandalay. Well, this is how some of our ancestors, not so very long ago, saw the Buddha, the great gourd bud. Hindus, of course, very often see the Buddha as a god. They see him as the ninth incarnation of their own god, Vishnu. But Buddhists themselves don't accept this. They don't accept that the Buddha was a human being in the ordinary sense, and they don't accept that he was a god, or God with a capital G. In the West, of course, the whole question is complicated by the fact that Buddhists are seen to worship the Buddha. I spoke a little while ago about Buddhists offering lighted candles to the Buddha. Well, they offer lots of other things. They offer incense, they offer flowers, they offer food, they offer tormas, they offer all sorts of symbolical representations of the whole universe. They offer all sorts of things. So, offer them, of course, before his image or his picture. And to the Christian or ex-Christian Westerner, this rather suggests that the Buddha is being treated as God, even that he is God for Buddhists, because in the West, customarily, worship is offered only to God. So that if you worship someone or something, it's thought he or it must be your God. But this is not true of Buddhism. In Buddhism, worship is offered to anyone who is superior, especially spiritually superior. And Eastern Buddhists will often speak of worshipping their parents. I used to hear pious Hindus say, well, I'll come out with you just in a minute, I'll just go and worship my parents first. Meaning they go to their parents, bow down, touch their feet, take their blessing, and then off they'd go. They'd call this worshipping their parents. In the same way, worship your teacher, even your primary school teacher. They speak of that too in those terms. They use the same word. It's derived from the Pali Sanskrit puja. Worship. So the fact that Buddhists worship the Buddha does not mean that they regard him as God. What then is the Buddha? If he is not man, if he is not God, who is he? Buddhists will say, usually, that he belongs to a third category. Not man, not God, whether with a small g or a capital G, belongs to a third category. A category quite separate and quite distinct from the other two. They will say that he is one who has completely eliminated greed, hatred, and delusion. One who knows from his own personal experience absolute reality. One who is, so to speak, at one with absolute reality. One who possesses supreme wisdom, who manifests infinite compassion. And they will say that one who has achieved all this by his own human efforts, but who has gone so far beyond humanity as we know it that he can no longer be called a man, without, nonetheless, assuming the cosmic functions that we usually associate with the idea of God, with a capital G, who is neither man nor God, who belongs to a distinct third category. He is Buddha, the Buddha. So that when we ask, who is the Buddha? We can really only say, he is the Buddha. In the text, the Khatiyas, the Brahmins, and so on, they cannot even say that, because after instructing them, the Buddha just disappears, and they are left wondering. They're left wondering, was he a deva or a man? We'll come back to that in a minute. Meanwhile, I want to say just something about the Buddha's other titles.